with John Walsh, co-hosts, and thanks to our engineer, Danielle Parks.
Thank you very much for listening. Tune in again next week. Stay on the air with us for Prison Pipeline, following us. Thank you very much.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KABU Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Pan-African Film Series hosted by the All African People's Revolutionary Party. The film this month is The Fall of Libya, showing Wednesday, February 24th at 6 p.m. at the Portland State University Smith Memorial Student Union in Room 329. The Fall of Libya is a short documentary of the role of imperialism played violently and illegally overthrowing the democratically elected Libyan government in 2011. Again, that's The Fall of Libya, Wednesday, February 24th at 6 p.m. at the Smith Memorial Student Union in Room 329 at Portland State University, 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. Again, that is 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm Amy Johnson. Tonight I'll be airing audio from a performance that took place on October 18th, 2015, at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. The performance was called With You on a Journey. It was the culmination of a series of writing workshops for family members of people in prison. The performance included 10 family members and 11 monologues, which told stories of having loved ones in prison. Tonight is part 4, and it includes the 7th and 8th monologues. They were written by a husband and wife, who both told stories of their son's incarceration. We'll begin tonight with Chris Karsmar introducing Paul and Cheryl.
Now I'd like to introduce Paul and Cheryl, who are married, and each of them will be telling the story of their son's incarceration.
Year one, out on bail. Reality had hit. It was true, he has been arrested. Now all of a sudden we are facing a series of events that are unknown and downright scary. Bail has been set, and we're not sure how we can come up with it because it exceeds the limits of all of our credit cards combined, the first option suggested. Well, we figure it out, and we make it happen. Now on to what's next. Because of his suicide risk, in order for Mark, our son, to live with us while on bail, we have to buy a gun safe or an antique shotgun, the pistol that has not been fired in nearly 35 years, and another son's hunting rifle. We read the restrictions of release and the legal jeopardy we'd be in if we all don't comply. One more layer of stress is added, as well as the feeling that we are no longer in control of our lives. He's out and at home with us now. The search begins for a private attorney, since public defenders are overloaded with cases. He finds one, and we write a check for $25,000. I step back one, or maybe 10 paces, to acknowledge the roller coaster ride of emotions I'm on. We're all on. Then the lawyer tells us that the less everyone knows about this, including the rest of the family, the better off everyone will be. You never know, they say, who may be called upon to testify and for what reason if this should go to trial. My guts roll over one more time. Do I really know this kid, our son, even if he is 43 years old now? What has happened while I thought he had a good marriage and life was moving forward for him? How can I hold all this inside without bursting? I would so like to be able to talk to someone outside of the house. I'm not sleeping very well. In a few days, a hearing happens. This is where the district attorney reads the original charge and a lot of others we were not prepared to hear. Although we have been told by lawyers to feel free to cover our ears, the court wants us to hear it all. And a good portion goes well beyond what I expected to hear and doesn't seem real. He is taken back into custody. This is a first-time offense, and it appears to include a lot of exaggerated charges created by taking the original one apart and making it severed. Now what? Well, now the bail amount is much larger, $1,750,000. Release amount is 10% of that, or $175,000. We certainly don't have that on hand. His attorneys tell us that if we can come up with that, they can work with him much more effectively, including the scheduling of evaluations and counseling. Oh, and by the way, the police may come to the house with a search warrant, looking for a cell phone that might have information that interests them. Try sleeping with that in your head. The thought of a group of officers churning through every drawer, closet, and you name it, looking for a phone that I know is not in our possession. What other thing, which they think is damning, might they find? We've never been here before, and I don't sleep. Now, how do we find another $150,000 to go with the original $25,000 of bail money? We tell Mark during visits that we are working on it, but don't know how fast we can put that much money together. By the way, be careful what you say during visits because everything is recorded. What may be used against him in court? Or maybe against us? We don't know. The thick glass you talk through is intimidating, and the experience of walking into a county jail cell area is very eerie to me. We have always lived below our means, saving for retirement. So yes, we can come up with the money. They tell us that if our son were to skip out while on release, the bail money is forfeited and we would be responsible for the entire $1,750,000. If he does not, we'll get most of the bail money back. Did you know the largest bill he print anymore is a $100 bill? I did not. We ultimately find it's easiest to deliver the bail in cash. So we walk into that county jail very casually with all that money in a briefcase, just like we had done it every day, hoping to not look conspicuous to anyone who might be looking our way. However, a level of distrust is surging through me about my fellow man and all the people we encounter between the parking lot and that jail. He's out again and in his mother's custody with his son and myself as alternates. He can hardly drive himself and his son to our house fast enough from that county jail. But even back at the house, it's just the next step into the unknown. I don't sleep well. Trips to see the lawyers begin. The counseling starts. It's another expense to absorb since he has no money of his own now. No longer having a job because his savings have been drained to support his kids. The first counselor does not work out well, but the second one does, and Mark is able to go twice a week. We find that the son we talked to during the day is all over the place with his emotions, from hatred to fear. But the one who writes very long letters in the middle of the night is another person with much more to offer and full of insight. So which one is the real one? I prefer to think the one who writes and who, like me, isn't sleeping much these days. Mark and his son join a bowling league. It is very therapeutic for both of them. It gives us a bit of a break also. Then they join another so they can get out of the house and on their own 2 evenings a week, a little more like old times. I don't believe I mentioned our grandson moved in with us so he could finish his college courses. Our living room has been turned into a dorm room for the two of them. The garage is full of their belongings because they no longer have a home of their own. Emotions are on high all the time. Things get tense between the two of them and between our grandson and ourselves, and flare-ups happen. Anxiety has disrupted life as we knew it. I try to put on a good face to keep things as calm as possible, but that's not at all what's going on inside of me. Time goes by, and the time draws near when a decision is needed to plea or go to trial. Another $15,000 goes to the lawyer. Everyone is on pins and needles. But I realize I am no longer thinking about police at the front door with that search warrant. Seems like such a minimal concern now. It's been nearly a year since his release, and a plea is decided upon in the 11th hour. 20 years seems better than going to trial, knowing that if he loses, it could mean up to 125 years in prison. The district attorney thinks they are being generous, offering just 20 years. Mitigating circumstances carry little weight, and mandatory minimums prevent the judge from making a determination and also seem to limit what the defense can do. Oh, did you know that juries do not know how long sentences are if you go to trial? They have no idea when they return a guilty verdict that that could mean anything from a year or 40 or more in prison. Seems a trial by jury of your peers ought to have some say about sentence length. I'm still not sleeping well, still too many unknowns. The plea is entered and back into custody he goes, another $8,500 to settle the lawyer's bill. Through all this, I worry about what my wife is going through. She is up late every night doing online research, trying her best to understand it all. She sleeps later in the morning than I do. I'm up early, having trouble staying asleep. I try to answer our grandson's questions and know that, in some ways, I will be assuming the role of his dad. And so ends year one. The next 20 begin.
You are listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Amy Johnson. You just heard a monologue written by Paul. It was part of a performance called With You on the Journey. Family members of people in prison tell their stories. Next up is a monologue written by Cheryl, Paul's wife.
The justice of mandatory minimums. Before our son's arrest, no one in our extended family had been convicted of a crime and sentenced to prison, so we had no personal contact with the criminal justice system. If we thought of it at all, it was because of some news story we heard, but interest and concern were minimal because we believed in our justice system. We innately trusted that the people working in the system, its caretakers, if you will, were dedicated to its principles. As we journeyed through this first involvement in the justice system, we were gradually overcome with disbelief. We joined others and found they too were discovering a strange world. Over and over you could hear, "It's not what I thought it was." Mark is the second youngest of our kids. He's now in the second year of a 20-year sentence. He's a father, stepfather, and grandfather, the youngest of whom will be 19 when his sentence is finished. Because he gets no time off for good behavior, he will serve every single day. We were angry at our son when he told us he was in jail. We were alarmed when the jail told us he was on suicide watch. and we were stunned when we heard the charges and the amount for bail. This was the start of our education about criminal justice system today. As we worked through this, Mark told us he knew he had to pay for what had happened, and we agreed there was a debt to be paid by him. But when he told us it could be 125 years, we were in disbelief. How could that be a plausible punishment, given all the information coming out during the investigation? We thought there were ample mitigating circumstances to consider when setting the sentence. We had no idea what mandatory sentencing is, so our education continued. We felt sure the psychological evaluations and polygraph test results would be considered. What about the fact that Mark had a long history of stability and employment and no criminal behavior? His three adult children were sure the accusations were lies. In 20-some years, they never saw this behavior. It had to mean something, too, that the grand jury testimony was so questionable that the DA, the district attorney, contacted Mark's lawyer to make sure he knew about it. Something his lawyer said just never happens. As pieces of the case came out, we were at the same time angry and heartbroken for our son, and heartbroken and protective of our step-granddaughter. It was impossible for me to hold the two of them in my mind at the same time. This isn't their story, it's mine. So suffice it to say that health issues that they both had, family dynamics at the time, and relationship betrayals all led to a moment of touching between child and adult. Totally inappropriate, regardless, but impossible to understand. When I told my counselor, my son or not, I cannot imagine myself ever allowing that to happen. How could he? Her response was to never say never. She added, every person is capable of things they swear they could never do. They say, I would never, and they really believe it until it happens, and then I see them here. This still isn't easy to understand, so I'll just fall back to what the psychologists say, that there are circumstances that might come into your life that can lower or entirely dissolve the inhibitors that control your behavior. Our son's psychological evaluations and the assessments by the psychologist point to that probability for him. During the 10 months he was with us, he was in counseling twice a week. Our granddaughter, living with her mother, was also in counseling during that time. The psychologist, hired by the state of Oregon to perform the evaluations on our son, reported that this was a single occurrence resulting from a perfect storm of events. Take out one event and it does not happen. And it's unlikely to ever happen again. The psychologist commented that this family would have been the perfect candidate for the way such cases were handled before Measure 11. Both parties would have received therapy and counseling separately. They would have been gradually brought together in his office, and eventually the family would have been reunited. There would have been a restored family in less than a year, and at much less than the $40,000 it costs to incarcerate one person for 1 year in an Oregon prison. Instead, the state of Oregon will pay nearly $1 million to just warehouse Mark for 20 years. There will be no therapy or counseling because there's no money for that in prison. In addition, the state is paying for public assistance for this family. And guess where all that money comes from? No, there won't be any rehabilitation, but Mark is receiving training. He's being trained to live in an institution. Decision-making is taken away. Everything is structured. So transitioning from an institution back to outside life and independent action becomes more difficult with each passing year. There's a premise from a national group, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, that if a person is not a threat to society, a shorter, swifter punishment would be in everyone's best interest. Measure 11 did away with reunifying whole families. Now the mandatory incarceration of fathers who commit crimes often ensures the breakup of families, but it doesn't stop there. It's documented that families with an incarcerated parent have a higher chance of poverty and continued dysfunction. Measure 11. While trying to ensure justice for victims, itself creates injustice and more victims. Our little granddaughters miss a father who has just disappeared from their lives. He will not be able to see them until they are adults too, 5 to 10 years from now. For a man whose family was everything, he now prays not to wake up in the morning. He doesn't intend to commit suicide. He just doesn't want to wake up. Sadness and depression are his constant companions. With Mark's incarceration, the public is not made safer. So what does this accomplish? Retribution only. In prosecuting the case, the DAs used the evidence selectively. On the one hand, they used it to induce a silent acceptance of prosecution. On the other hand, they used it to hype the guilt of my son. They took one charge and turned it into five. It went from a mandatory sentence of 25 years to 125 years. It was astonishing. Where was the pursuit of truth? Where was the administration of justice? This was wrong. But all we heard from the lawyers, who agreed it was wrong, was, that's the way it is. There evidently wasn't anything they could do about it. It's how plea bargains are done. Scare people away from trials and into pleading guilty. Win-win. The defendant doesn't face 125 years, and the DA gets an easy conviction for his resume. Mark's lawyers prepared a 70-page proposal package for the DAs that contained testimony, psych evals, tests, summations from four psychologists, conclusions, and recommendations. 30 minutes after receiving it, they called with an offer of 20 years. Did they even look at it? They didn't have to, because Measure 11 doesn't require them to consider anything but the crime. But they said that because Mark was a good guy and had been cooperative, they did want to do something for him. So they changed the level of the crime to attempted. That took it out of Measure 11, so they could make his sentence 20 years instead of the mandatory 25. But then they added back in Measure 11 restrictions, and that means no time off for good behavior. It becomes a mandatory minimum sentence by DA manipulation. What a joke. That's what Measure 11 was going to do away with. human discretion and manipulation. Oh, judges can't be trusted. DAs can. It's been a mistake to take away a judge's discretion to look at all of the evidence and then apply a sentence to fit the crime. It's wrong to put first-time offenders with no previous criminal history under mandatory sentencing. One strike, you're out. Consider again the two sentencing alternatives here. A pre-measure 11 sentence of restoration consisting of probation, intense counseling that reunites the family, returns a rehabilitated person to society to be a tax-paying citizen. Or the sentence of retribution, a mandatory 20 years that warehouses a person who will not commit this crime again. A sentence that cost Oregon taxpayers a minimum of $800,000 and returns to society an institutionalized individual with limited options who may continue to be a responsibility of the state. My son himself said he deserves to be punished, but how can a law alone, with the crime as the only consideration, set the number of years that will be appropriate punishment? Truly, does one number fit every case for every person who commits that one crime? Is it wrong to consider any circumstances beyond the crime itself? What about you? Would you like your justice personal or impersonal? Do you want it to be really appropriate and meaningful? Or is retribution just the same for everybody, regardless, good enough? So I have one last question. Would your family like to have $1 million from the state of Oregon too? Well, now you know how to get it.
You've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. I want to thank Carol Imani for organizing With You on the Journey, Director Chris Karsmar, Assistant Director Melissa Schmitz, and all the participants of With You on the Journey. Stay connected to With You on the Journey at facebook.com/withyouonthejourney, which is all one word. I will post notifications of when the next segments of With You on the Journey will air on that page. You can also find Carol Imani's email address there if you have questions about the project or would like to share your stories as a family member of someone in prison. Again, that's facebook.com/withyouonthejourney. Thank you to our engineers, Danielle and Mike. Good night.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification, a public lecture by Jeff Halper, Tuesday, February 23rd at 7 p.m. at the First United Methodist Church in Portland. Jeff Halper is the longtime head of the Israel Committee Against House Demolitions and is known for his activism on the ground in support of Palestinian rights and a just peace. Jeff will be on a book tour for his recently published book, War Against the People. Again, that's War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification, a public lecture by Jeff Halper, Tuesday, February 23rd at 7 p.m. at the First United Methodist Church, 1838 Southwest Jefferson in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Setup, a play that takes place in Hell's Kitchen during the late 1920s. It focuses on a black boxer, an eminent champion whose return to the ring is secretly set up for defeat. The setup runs from February 12th through March 5th at the Shaking the Tree Theater, 823 Southeast Grant Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor In a Time of Extinctions, a call to life Saturday, February 27th, 7 p.m. at the Central Lutheran Church in Portland. In a Time of Extinctions, a call to life is a benefit concert for 350 PDX, the local chapter of 350.org. The concert will feature vocalist Kathleen Dean Moore and concert pianist Rochelle McKay performing a program of words and music. Again, that's in A Time of Extinctions, a call to life Saturday, February 27th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Central Lutheran Church, 1820 Northeast 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 7 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Hard Knock Radio will return at this hour tomorrow. Instead, tonight, here's this week's episode of Law and Disorder.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we consider some particular aspects of the legacy of former Justice Antonin Scalia.
Many commentators have noticed the homophobia of Justice Scalia's opinions, but what we highlight is his jurisprudence of death.
We'll listen to excerpts from a special event